Welcome. I'm Jessica Teigen, and this is the Evolving to Exceptional podcast, where we talk about reaching peak performance in our workplaces, homes, and communities so that we can live our best life possible, an exceptional life. Welcome back to all of our Evolving to Exceptional listeners. I am Jessica Teigen, and I'm joined here today by Barry Engelhart. He is the Human Resources Director at Store Supply Warehouse, amongst his many other jobs that he also performs in supporting the St. Louis SHRM group and their programming and the work that they do. Barry has a really interesting and diversified background, including a military background that has had a big impact on how he leads the HR function, which we're going to talk about today. But before we get into some of those topics and before we get into some of your experiences, Barry, can you give us just a little bit of background about who you are, how you got to where you are, and why it is that you do what you do, what it is that makes you so passionate about the role that you perform and the job that you fill?
Absolutely. Most of the time when I submit bios, I lead off by classifying myself as a reformed art miscreant and a professional generalist. I think a lot of people read that and think I'm being quirky because I hate bios and their self-serving nature, and they'd be right. But there's a lot more truth and a lot more value in those terms when I try to ask myself who I am and how I've gotten to where I've gotten to be. I'll also sometimes throw in that I'm the son of a 50s farm boy turned coal mine and steel mill mechanic. I don't know if there is a way to succinctly describe who I am better than that, but especially the professional generalist. I went to college and majored in psychology, minored in creative writing. There was a point in time where I thought I was going to go off in the mountains and read and write pretentious literature. Soon after I graduated, military activations changed my mind. I'd been in the Army National Guard for a couple of years at that point. And I stayed in the military for 20 years as a part-time, weekend a month, 2 weeks a year, if as needed, based on the president or the governor, a capacity. And later in life, I spent about 10 years in operations and client relationship management, and then I started to pursue my MBA, and I soon realized a lot of my MBA program, because it was for working professionals, focused in on your experience up to that point. I started realizing how much I had taken from the military and how I was referencing those lessons much more than the first 10 years in the private sector. In retrospect, it's not as shocking as it felt at the time. Realistically, the United States government's poured over $1 million into my leadership development. I don't know how they get to those facts and figures, but I'm sure they can and do. I've went for 2, 3, 4 weeks at a time to leadership-based schools. Some of them were as simple as like a combatives program, but it was always focused on this is how you learn to be a train the trainer mentality. How do you grow, develop, teach? So there was a lot of things in there that I think I took for granted. About 10 years down my professional career, I flipped the script to going from operations in the forefront to HR in the background to then HR in the forefront, operations in the background. I did that at my old job for about 6 years. And then I transitioned to Store Supply about three and a half years ago, where it's been all HR, full steam. I'm a lot of things outside of that too, but that is pretty well my professional journey.
So I have to ask, because this just jumped out at me as you were talking about that and the leadership training that you got in that military background. Having been in both kind of the private sector and the military background, do you think one does it better? Do you think the military does a better job of providing that necessary training or that development, personal growth and development? Or do you think it gets about equal and the private sector's got it nailed too?
I don't know if I'd say they do it better, but I think it's more habitually built into their structure And I think they do it more. I think they recognize that decisions can realistically and 100% be life and death decisions. And if you don't pour into that, then shame on you. I don't know. It's different. I could do stereotype cliches about a 19-year-old landing, helping land an airplane on a deck in the middle of the ocean, and they'd be right. I can do cliches on people get promoted into their first leadership role at 30 and taught how to do it for the first time at 42. But I think a lot of organizations do a lot of great things, and I almost hate to box it in and even pretend the private sector is the private sector, because even from an HR standpoint, I could work for a place where their mentality is very reactive, very don't get me sued, get butts in seats. I could work in a place that says, I truly value our people. They're the lifeblood of our organization, and we're going to pour into. And I have my opinions, but I'm not going to argue one's right or wrong as much as private sector results may vary.
Yeah. No, that's totally fair. I think that makes a lot of sense that the military would have maybe more consistent application, but the quality can vary dramatically based on where you're at and what you're getting. So tell me a little bit about some of the biggest challenges you've faced in the last year with respect to people and performance in your workplace. What are some of the biggest issues you've been grappling with or having to navigate through and try to find solutions for?
The first thing that comes to mind, I'd say I actually have recently gotten out of, but I started here at Store Supply maybe 6 weeks before the COVID lockdown. But in that environment, but also just starting here in general, there was a lot of very tenured, very experienced managers. And I learned very quickly, I could not tell them what to do. I could be exclusively right, but especially the way our company operates, where very customer focused packages must get out the door immediately, Groundhog Day almost. Like, you do everything that happens that day. Hopefully you clean up and you start over again. Anything I asked a manager to do would be a deterrent from what they are being measured on and judged. So I had to spend a lot of time putting debits in and earning my keep and proving that, frankly, I knew what the heck I was talking about, and really making managers think that the things I'm doing are supporting them, and the things I'm doing will actually, even if it is an immediate show, over time will free up time to and help them do their jobs more effectively. So I'd say for a good year, and somewhat understandably so, as I had to learn the ways of the land and start over myself, people would stare at me like I'm crazy. I didn't necessarily see them. They were on the phone a lot of time. I knew what was happening and I got it. I knew I was going to hang up and business was going to be as usual. So earning that and just putting in debit after debit so that every once in a while, I have to pull credit out. So much has to work that way. And I think that was my biggest challenge. And it took, especially, I think COVID helped me in a lot of ways, but it also hindered me in a lot of ways because it wasn't normal times for good and for bad. I was leaned on probably more, but I also wasn't functioning in on the day-to-day what people truly do as the backbone and lifeblood of this company. So I would say just really earning people's respect and trust, and even coming in and say, look, I know we're about to have an uncomfortable conversation with someone. I can lead, I can follow. All you need to do is tell me which, and understand my job is to support where you're going and get you as comfortable as you can be doing these things yourself.
So as you did that, as you put in those debits and earned the trust of your managers and your leaders, what are some of the things that you discovered they needed or that they really were wanting to rely upon or lean upon you for as a resource? So as you developed those relationships, what was it that they were really needing support to help with their people or with the work that they were doing from a people and performance perspective?
It would be easy to say finding the right people, but at the end of the day, supply and demand matrix were not in our favors, but trying to maximize the people we found, trying to understand why people were leaving. When I started this company, they said, if someone stays around for 6 months, we have them forever. The data supported that. But honestly, the data shrank down to 90, if not 30 days. So really focusing in on trying to streamline that process, but also make it effective and just to really support them, especially when and if they were uncomfortable and or unfamiliar with something. And I think really, I know I said it before, but really give probably something the military taught me was begin with the end in mind. So they were having performance issues. One of the first questions I would ask is, what is your intended goal here? Are we trying to build this person up or are we not? Is this someone you need to manage out? Because it's your house, your rules. I'm not going to tell you who, unless you're being egregious, I'm not going to tell you who to keep or who to lose. I don't have that level of knowledge you do, but I can help you get a plan in a choose your own adventure world where we can go left or we can go right. But I need to know, one, am I leading or am I following? And two, where are we going? Where do you want this to go?
Yeah, I can totally relate to that because, and I don't know about you, but oftentimes I think they're not always totally sure when you ask that question. It's almost, I don't know, do I want to keep them or don't? It doesn't necessarily occur to them that there's that choice first of, are we going to try to make this work with this person or are you just done and we're just trying to figure out how to exit them? But it certainly speeds up the decision-making process and the next steps when you have that clarity. As you worked with managers and you looked at those kind of statistics around retention, you talked about that they, if they were there 6 months, then you had them. Were you able to identify why that was the case or what you could do to increase the likelihood that you would end up with the right resources? Was there data or information that was helping to provide that information or that perspective?
Part of it was a chicken and an egg. There's definitely choke points where if our warehouses was understaffed by one person, things would probably be fine. But if they were understaffed by two people, managers weren't able or convinced they were able to really focus in on the new person. And so it was trial by fire. And we have, and also as people were being pushed to do more, you ran a risk of even a more tenured person that had been happy either momentarily or completely breaking. So I think really the hard answer is saying get the numbers right so there wasn't such a strain on the system. The easy or the more short-term answer, which wasn't easy at all, was to convince people never be too busy to invest time in things that will make you less busy moving forward. That was really the biggest thing. Because again, they're getting pushed, like you got to get everything done by the end of the day. That's what operations was measuring them on. So it was sometimes hard to get them out of their own way or their own head, so to speak. Like even there were times where I'm too busy to interview. It's okay, but if one more person quits, you're going to be even busier. But if one more person comes in the system, things should ease up. So you cannot, I'm sorry, you just cannot. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And it is an interesting conundrum that managers find themselves in when they are so short staffed and they haven't planned ahead and they haven't made sure that they have the resources that they need. And they get into that, like you said, chicken and an egg. Where do I focus first? Especially when they're really concerned with metrics, their data, their operations metrics and execution data. And you mentioned that it's a really customer service driven organization. I've worked for that in the past as well. And so people will tend to really kill themselves to meet those customer demands and to fulfill on those metrics or those requests. What have you done from, I've talked a little bit about HR analytics and data and how you see those as being really important in those conversations and in looking at the metrics around your people data. Why do you feel like those are so important? Why are those analytics so important to what you're doing as an HR director?
They separate fact from perception. I won't pretend that I have got this code cracked by any means. Last year, I went through a program and got certified in HR analytics through Cornell. A few weeks ago, I took beginning and intermediate SQL classes. And talking to HR colleagues, I got the, why the hell are you doing that? And I'm like, have to. This is the way of the world. Like, I'm trying to grow my Power BI knowledge, but the answer I would give you is one report at a time. It's a pretty steep learning curve. I remember in college having the statistics teacher who seemed prideful on the fact that, look around, 50% of you will drop my course. Like, he reminded you when drop date was on a daily basis. It was brutal. And I honestly was one of those people that dropped. But I've poured a lot of my discretionary time and effort, and frankly, a solid amount of this company's money. But I work for a data-centric company. If I went out to the warehouse, we have a pay-for-performance program, and it's dialed. If you have to grab two packages, it knows this package is way down there and it's going to take longer. It knows that package requires more time and effort to get ready to ship. And it can tell anyone within a respectable margin of error how hard they should be working. Finance can tell you on a moment's notice where you're making money, where you're losing money. Operations, marketing can tell you what tweak of the website works. For HR to pretend that they're not a part of the business that needs to understand numbers and understand and be, and I'm not going to pretend I'm anywhere near where I want to be on forecasting, but how to forecast the future as opposed to my gut says we need to do this. That's where the rubber meets the road.
So what are some of those numbers? What are some of those HR data analytics or people-related measures that are important to look at? What are the things that you are wanting to try to put in place or maybe have put in place to look at from an analytics standpoint?
One of the, probably the foundational thing I've spent the most time on, and I think this is a little bit circumstantially dependent because we do have a lot of entry level to intermediate level experienced employees in our system, and especially in the warehousing industry through COVID, has been getting pay rights. I can't just look at a survey and say, oh, we should be paying this, for the simple fact that survey would tell me that we have no problem. In reality, would prove otherwise. I track what every market pays using so many different methods, including a couple surveys that I've found that are monthly as opposed to yearly, but also I have what I call my reality data, which is I just get on Indeed and I run the report that shows me these are the 10 most clicked positions in your market. That tells me that they've got the push data. People are going to them for whatever reason. I look and try to find out what they're paying. I've got full data, which is the front page. It's what the 15 people who are dumping the most money into the system, in theory, they're the most hungry and or desperate for employees. So I look at what all these people are paying, and then I average all these things out, and then I track this on a monthly basis. I've tracked it for years. And then from there, we look at a macro levels reality versus perception. In my opinion, we should probably be paying a dollar higher here, but we have great retention. We have wonderful employees. We're getting the job done. Like, then we have a conversation. Are we giving money away when we don't have a problem, or should we proactively adapt to this as opposed to reactively? Conversely, we look at another market and it looks like we're paying over, but we know for a fact that we're in a warehousing district and the place next door that just opened literally has a sign that is showing they're paying a dollar more than we are to start. Every interview sees that. Every person sees that on their way to and from work every day. So matrixes, unfortunately, be damned. Like, that sign matters more than anything, because that sign gets all the touch points. So I would say 80% data is everything, but you also have to be realistic and find the piece of the puzzle outside of the data that has the most power.
Yeah, and it's interesting in looking at a lot of the HR analytics, like things like you're talking about with compensation data, and there's things like that where you can get access to that information really easily. And then there was like a whole influx of data when it came, when everybody went remote. And so you could, Microsoft 365 has all these different tracking mechanisms, so you can see productivity and how often people are on systems. And of course, we've all probably seen some of this, the silly social media videos of the mouse mover or whatever to make it look like you're on your computer when you're not on your computer, when you're remote and things like that. There's all this potential data to look at. And I'm curious of some of your thoughts around, as you navigate what all the data is that you could look at, how you hone in on the data that's going to bring you the most value, like where the metrics are that are going to help you really add value to your organization moving forward. Are there things that you've identified that you would really like to get more data on, or that would really bring you more value versus just more data? Or what are your thoughts on that?
I think engagement data is probably what I really want to hone in. We've done surveys for years, but I don't have that composite data. I know on a broad stroke what it all says. We have partners who come in and help us debate and discuss what is the most pressing issues for year over year, as well as just current, and they can compare it to what other people are seeing. But what I'd really like to interestingly try to get myself down to is where I've entered in those scores to a point where I can not necessarily look at causation, but correlation, and see what non-intuitive things are shifting other things, what is standing out on high-performing locations versus low-performing locations that aren't necessarily the things that you would think of or feel. But I would really, and I would love to get to the point of forecasting headcounts from an operations standpoint. They've got that locked in. But for me to truly forecast based on tenure, based on turnover, based on all these things, and combine those two to where they're even stronger together than separate, and bring that data, bring my data and their data in and intertwine it. That's where it's really going to get interesting and powerful. And like I said, I'm not there yet.
But yeah,
I get a little closer. But to get to go back to what you said, I think 99% of data is garbage. I think you have to know what your priorities are, know what your strategic plan is, and know what data matters. Otherwise, you're just on overwhelm and overload, and it's all a distraction. I've had conversations before where people were freaking out a salaried person was leaving a little early without telling anyone. And I'm like, is that the problem? That's not the problem. If this guy was, it was a guy in this case, but if this individual was doing exceptional, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So let's not focus in on the wrong piece of data. Let's have the tough conversation about why you even noticed. Because the military taught me there's two focal points. You can work to standard or you can work to time. And I'm a big fan of working to standard.
Well, and it's interesting, as I think about the military too, one of the areas that I think, I believe that there will be a greater maybe usage of neuroperformance-based metrics. So metrics that are really human-based metrics that versus system or data-based metrics. Things like heart rate variability for monitoring stress levels, or emotional intelligence metrics, or coherence metrics, or biofeedback, brainware type of devices. And certainly the military is well known for its focus on health and fitness, right? That someone who's strong, who's well taken care of, who follows those regimens is going to perform better, is going to be able to show up and do the job better than somebody who is not in that type of physical state, or who has not put in that kind of effort. And so I think it'll be interesting as that kind of area continues to expand, to look at people's performance, not just based on system or what is produced within our operations or business systems, but also with how they're actually performing, what is their capacity for performance, and being able to manage that in a way where you can get better results out of people, where you can get and make sure that people are managing themselves effectively to get those results and outcomes.
Yeah, I think that gets hard. As I stand here with my Apple Watch, I look at what's happened in the personal space in those dimensions just since Fitbit's joined the arena. Gamification, things have been exceptional. To say that we've shifted that into the corporate world for wellness programs. Some people do it better than others. Some people spend a lot more money, but there comes a point where you have to get the buy-in and truly make people understand and enjoy and want to participate. I'm a big fan of treating people like adults. And one thing I absolutely go nuts on is when people try to manage the lowest common denominator. And so when you talk about like mouse movement and all this stuff, I just want to shake my head and scream and say, wow, you're so downstream from the actual problem. If you're concerned how many times a person's clicking a mouse, then, and I think my favorite podcast in the world is like Andrew Huberman's. I love the concept of neuroscience. I think it's interesting to see the psychology I started in 20 years ago and actual science and biology starting to intertwine. I find it absolutely fascinating. And I think we're in a resurgence in that period. And it's fascinating, but I also wonder how much is too much. I wonder what are the things that you can capture that's good for both sides, where you're supplying people, your employees benefit, you're gaining benefit, and you're truly helping people to learn, understand, grow, function better, lower their stress, increase their health, increase their productivity, even something as simple as 25 minutes of labor, 5 minutes of rest will increase your productivity, those type of things. Because I worry there's a lot of people in the world that are mouse click monitors as well. And when you talk about that, and those people, let's face it, are not going to cut their top performers, no matter how much they are clicking their mouse, becomes just discrimination and game playing, because they're not focused on the problem, they're focused on the symptom.
Yeah, you end up wasting a lot of time and effort and energy around trying to track things that are not actually indicative of performance results, like how often you're clicking a mouse and tracking all of that data. And I think what's interesting about what you talked about, and I couldn't agree more with everything you said, is a lot of the wellness programs tend to focus on nice to have. It would be nice if you walked more steps, or it would be nice if type of scenarios. I liked your example of your productivity is going to increase, or you're going to be more effective if you work for 25, rest for 5. Really practical strategies, and giving people the data for themselves. So instead of it being corporate data that has to be tracked or monitored, when it comes to the neuroscience of performance, it is, in my mind, it's as much about equipping people with the knowledge and information so that they can recognize, oh, and I'm in like a stress state right now, actually. I should probably take a few minutes, do some breathing, and then I'll be more productive again. I need to take a walk around the office, get my head on straight. I should stop because I'm not being as effective as I could be because I'm in a state of stress. And so if we can equip people with that knowledge and the tools to help support them, that will drive some of those, I think, performance outcomes and objectives that gets away from, like you said, the over the lowest common denominator type of issues that really just waste time.
Yeah. And it just has to be two-sided. When you tell somebody, hey, if you work hard for 25 minutes, a 5-minute break, and it's good for everybody, they're going to get behind that. You tell somebody, hey, when you work for an hour and then spend 15 minutes on Facebook, you've done the same thing, but by the way, you haven't, because your brain energy level has not changed in any shape, form, or fashion. Whether they know it or not, they don't care. They're doing, one, what they want to do with those 10 minutes, and two, they're getting the dopamine and all that good stuff too. So that's not going to be effective to tell people to tell it in that way. But the company also has to realize that 5-minute break, you can't tell them on Facebook. If someone chooses to, that's, you just gave them a break. So it gets a little awkward on how to truly go about it in a selfless way, or not even selfless, in a way that both sides truly see benefit.
Yeah, no, it's definitely true. And I think that'll be one of the hurdles when it comes to optimizing performance of people as we move forward into the future, as we continue to incorporate so much technology into what we do, and that the real return on investment is going to be that people component and how we change behavior, how we change how people perform, how we work with the neuroscience of their neural pathways to help them shift how they do things is all going to be part of the future of performance and how people perform in the future. I'm curious, just to shift gears a little bit, we talked before about some of the challenges that come from communicating when you've got a really distributed workforce, when you've got people out and you're trying to get the same communications out, you're trying to get everybody on the same page. Why do you think that communications continue to be such a challenge, despite the fact that we have so much technology, so many options for enhancing communication?
I think the answer was fortunately and unfortunately in the question, which is there's so much. I don't think there's any industry in the world more saturated and more competitive than competing for people's time and attention from a micro level. There's constantly times where I feel like I've over communicated, and then I have 5 people ask me the question that I've over communicated. And I think it just has to be communicated in several different ways through several different layers and several different methodologies before you can risk even getting an 80% saturation. And then frankly, even if someone heard it, even if someone truly remembered it, if it's something that they're not going to need for a while, there's no guarantee they're going to remember it. I've done a lot of things, like I try to do benefits reminders once a month, and I'm not as consistent as I wish I were, but just reminders like, hey, did you know about telehealth? Hey, did you this? Did you that? And it's never enough. And I don't have a great answer. I think we've gotten better. I think during COVID, we got great at communicating. And I think we fell in that stereotypical trap of we just stopped for a little while. We soon learned that was something people really appreciated. And we've picked it back up. We do a monthly newsletter. Our marketing department does a great job with. I personally find it a little cheesy, but everybody I work with doesn't think or believe like I do. It's been an exceptionally powerful medium to pepper people with a little reminder here and there. But then if we just relied on the newsletter, it would only get to the people that care about the newsletter. If we send out an email blast, or we tell managers to work it into meetings, and we just keep seeping it down through the pores, unfortunately, we have to find several methodologies, because we have several different types of workers and different people are going to gravitate to different things. So I think the market's been segmented a bit more because of all the different technology. And I think it's been overwhelmed and overloaded. So Unfortunately, the closest answer I have is to overload it even more, which is obviously critical, but a lot, it's the most effective thing.
So I'm curious, as we think about communications, kind of got two purposes, right? One is to impart information, and the other is to, I think, also try to create that connection or that understanding, awareness, building the culture, especially when we're talking about internal organizations within a workplace. It's both for information, but also to create that community. And it became really important when people were virtual and going through COVID and some of those challenges. And in some cases, it seemed like we even maybe got a little bit better, at least for a while. But then this other problem came about that you raised to me in our first call, and that is some of the disconnection or the loneliness that's happening, and the fairly recent Surgeon General's report on the loneliness and the levels of loneliness that are existing in our country, or the level of disconnection that currently exists in the United States. And I know this is a topic that's coming up, I think, next week at a St. Louis SHRM event. But tell me just a little bit about what you found most interesting about that report and about that the challenge of loneliness and the disconnection that it clearly is an issue or a challenge in communities and workplaces today.
Yeah, I have. So the current Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, between being a Surgeon General in one administration and being the current Surgeon General, he wrote a book called Together, which I probably would have never read if it hadn't been a selection from a book club I'm in. I'm so glad I did. At the time, I basically said this is the most important and powerful book I read that year. And I'm a fairly prolific reader. I probably average about a book a week. So to say that is, I don't say that lightly. And that was pre-COVID. And it was very clear that was only going to be an accelerant. But the concept that they have data that suggests loneliness can have the same physiological and more so physical effects as smoking a pack of cigarettes a day is mind-blowing to me. I can look back on, and this is dating me and my preferences, but you watch, there's a music video of when Johnny Cash covered Nine Inch Nails' Hurt, and you just see just pure heartbreak. He had just recently lost his wife. He is so decrepit. And you fast forward a month, maybe 2 months, Johnny Cash had passed away. There's always been that weird, like, ideological, almost people dying of heartbreak. But if you, it's a real thing, like, people die immediately after their spouse. It's crazy to think, but I would equate this to a very obvious proof that of how powerful loneliness can be. And I have probably a fairly unpopular opinion of work from home. I don't believe a company can maintain a culture that is really truly worked into the pores without proximity. I believe you lose out on creativity. I believe you lose out on those random conversations where Jeff from marketing's talking to Kelly from accounting and they have this weird random idea that adjoins their problems, because you can't get that from a Zoom call, and you can't get that from sending people a hoodie every 6 months or this mandatory fun once a year, bring everybody together. I just don't understand. Do I believe in hybrid? Yes. Do I believe in flexibility? Absolutely. Am I trying to say this is one size fits all and no one should ever work from home? Absolutely not.
Right.
But I believe there are very serious personal and professional repercussions of a more spread out, more less proximity or workforce where people aren't coming together. And you hear all the arguments, people quit their manager, they don't quit their job. I would argue people stay for their coworkers. There's been times where
definitely true.
I wouldn't classify somebody as my best friend or even hang out with them outside of work. Even though I was frustrated, the concept of leaving that person alone to deal with the current situation was just not even something I could comprehend, because I would, even though I wouldn't be, I would feel like I was just completely betraying the person. And I don't understand how you maintain these things professionally. And I also don't understand how people get the connection that they truly need at home. I love not driving to the office when and if I don't have a reason to. I love taking a meeting in basketball shorts. And frankly, I love getting up and doing something around the house here or there from time to time. I'm not convinced I wouldn't enjoy working from home full time, but I am positive I could not personally, at minimum, be as effective, even if I was being far more efficient. And I remember when Elon Musk came out with his work from home mandate, everybody, some people who I think are some of the most brilliant people in the world, were freaking out. And I'm like, methodology, horrible. I think it was a stunt, a game, and I think he wanted to quit. But the bottom line is, he runs a company where the backbone, at least at Tesla, have to be in a factory floor. And maybe this is, again, the military in me, but leaders eat last. If my people in the warehouses have to be in the warehouses every day, I don't feel like I get the right or the ability to work from home, because that just feels like a giant hypocrisy. I get people could argue why it's different, but the way I've been brought up as a fifth in a small towns, and the way the military's taught me, that's just part of my personal wiring.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You're right about so many different things. You mentioned in terms of connection and the broken heart syndrome, there's actual neuroscience evidence, and there's examples of where quite literally there's like a valve in the heart that can shut itself off. And that's part of the broken heart syndrome, why people actually feel pain when they lose someone in their heart, because their heart is responding to that. And our heart, and I constitute that as another, it's another one of our brains. We have neurons in our heart that hold memories and perform functions just like our brains do, our head brains do. And our hearts are responsible for some of that connection, that need for relationship and connection with other people. And I think you're right. It's much more difficult to develop that connection in a remote environment, but it's also difficult in an environment that doesn't provide opportunity or support the development of that connection, or the time spent to develop that connection, the culture around those connections. And I think what's interesting when it comes to the loneliness, the report and around connection and the health implications and the consequences that are pretty significant to us as a society, is figuring out how do we navigate how we work using what we know about what people need from a human performance standpoint, from a human needs standpoint. And I think it may be something, I wonder a little bit if it's something we haven't even necessarily fully realized in our current state, because our paradigms are still stuck into an either or mentality versus something that's even more profound or more significant in terms of how you develop those connections. And I loved your comment about coworkers too, because interestingly, it's one of the things that, having left my prior organization a few years ago, it's probably one of the things that still is the hardest part about not being there still, is those relationships, right? Those connections and people and friendships that I had. And I've also seen it where it's actually what keeps people in toxic workplaces. So people will stay longer in a workplace that's really unhealthy and not good for them because they have those close relationships. So for better or worse, having people within an organization have connection and have relationships is actually really important. But historically, it seems as though a lot of workplaces have not encouraged that connection building, that it's been leave your personal life at home, or this is just a professional relationship, and you wouldn't necessarily have developed some of that deeper connection in the past. Do you think that maybe has changed a little bit? And what are you seeing in your own community or workplace with respect to the connection, loneliness, mental health challenges that we're seeing?
I think we have been a unique specimen in the fact that we did not, our warehouses never shut down, and we were back in the office fairly quickly. By the 4th of July 2020, we had 80% of people back in the office. We treated it as a physical and mental concern. By that, we stress that if you had a true physical reason to not come back to the office, you did not need to come back to the office. Also, if it was bad for you mentally to not come back to the office, HR and or your manager is open to having those conversations. And we never told anyone no. There was a point where COVID cases started spiking back up, and one person tested the waters and found out we weren't full of it, and suddenly half that department was back working from home again. There's a few people, for reasons I won't go into that are personal to them, but real, have never came back to the office. But we really were together as a group for the majority of COVID. Now, I'm not going to pretend that there weren't times where I couldn't sleep up at night because I was convinced one of our warehouses was going to get completely shut down. I'm also not going to pretend that in retrospect, I didn't get super lucky, because it's an open air, very tall environment where people really didn't need to be on top of each other for more than a few seconds, unless they created it, and they weren't creating those type of situations because of the obvious. But we really endured. One thing I really appreciated, and I've totally the script on this question, I apologize, but one thing I found and I appreciated, and it's going back to communication. My first few communications on COVID were horrible. When I flipped the script and when I really found something that resonated, I stopped talking about it as I, and by that any person like themselves, and started talking about for each other. And I started integrating our values, which are respect, knowledge, and teamwork. And at first I thought I was just being cute, peppering our values into another thing for a touch point, but it really felt like that's when the communications actually meant something to people, is when we made it about someone else and we made it focused in on who we are and what we're trying to accomplish. I could go all day and talk about, oh, we're a customer focused place and the packages need to go out. It's important and it wouldn't matter, but it's not going to internally resonate. But when you start talking about, this is who we are, and this, and you're helping each other, then suddenly everything clicked and it felt like we were having strong communication that people read, people appreciated, people commented.
I love that. And I think that is really true to communication in general, that when you can bring that level of authenticity and connection into the communication, it tends to resonate that much more with those that are receiving it. I'm curious, just to shift gears one last time, what is something right now that your business is facing or that you would really most like to bring to your business to support your business? What is it that your business most needs right now that would really bring it value and help it in whatever challenges it's facing in the present?
Unfortunately, I laugh because the first thing that comes to mind is a crystal ball. Just with the uncertainty of the current economy, someone could ask me to argue for 5 minutes and make a convincing argument that we're not going into a recession, or that we are guaranteed to go under a recession. I could probably do it fairly easily. We've never been at a point where inflation and job security did that. We're in a world where it's very much, we're going to see what happens. And I think just the flexibility and the balance and the trust and the togetherness and building. I mean, another thing I learned from the military is really nothing short of possibly other than maybe art brings people from a diverse background together, like shared sacrifice. I've been in a company where, unfortunately, due to a rather large expansion that went south, they had to delay payroll by a week. And I was part of that planning process. I was behind closed doors going, I can't picture a world where we don't lose 20% of our workforce to do this. And ownership was, I agree, but we have no choice and we are going to lose 20%. And we were very honest and very transparent. I would say we lost one manager and it was 6 months later over that. We didn't lose anyone. And I'm talking 175 people spread out through the entire Midwest. And I still to this day can't fathom that. But when I look at deployments, when I look at people that if I met on the street at first impression, I may not have even liked, that I today look at like brothers and that I would do anything for. People come together when they have a common goal and a shared sacrifice. And if for any reason we have to have a shared sacrifice, I just hope that we've prepared enough and we are flexible enough to lean into that and be proactive as opposed to reactive.
I love that. I love that. And my other question that kind of goes along with that is, as an HR leader, what is it that you most need? What is it that would most bring you value right now as an HR leader?
I think balance. I spoke a lot with very strong opinions, and strong opinions are a life skill of mine. But we go back to saying, what does the manager want to accomplish? Is it that they want this person to be terminated, or they want to try to hopefully fix the issue? There needs to be that flexibility, but there also can't be too much flexibility because you can't discriminate either. I hoped COVID would kill the term work-life balance because it's this magic scale. I wanted it to, and it really felt like it was becoming work-life integration, but I'm hearing that phrase and it's probably hypocritical because I say, what do I want? Balance, but integration or flexible complexity. I hate this or that. Yes or no, black or white. I believe that there's a lot of gray, and there's a lot, if you're dealing in complex problems, you're usually living in the middle, and that creativity, that flexibility, but knowing when and how you're swinging the pendulum too far one way or the other, because at the end of the day, too much flexibility is going to result in discrimination, and you can't do that. But too tight of a policy and procedure locks you into a box you can't escape. And you can't do that either because circumstances should and can dictate terms. So I think finding that level of flexibility, doing what's right for the employer, but not at the expense of the employee, like having that middle ground and finding solutions that move everyone forward together while being realistic to the needs of both sides.
I love that. And one of the ways I like to think about balance is more about just a balanced life overall, rather than balance between work and life, because it's really just one thing. And then figuring out, how do we balance ourselves within it? How do we balance how we exist and how we live and how we show up and our experiences and all the things that we do within our lives? So Barry, it's been so great having you on here. We've gotten to talk about a lot of different things. I want to give you a chance to give any final thoughts to our audience before we wrap this up.
Sure. I have a motto that I very wholeheartedly lean into, and it probably goes back to the metaphor of the debits and credits. I mean, you look at a 401k account and the power of compounding interest. I believe that everything functions that way. There's compounding effort. And this saying I try to live by, which is, small things done consistently change the world. And I think really, if there's something someone is struggling to accomplish or really wants to grow in, something as simple as not drinking a can of soda every day for a year is the difference of almost 10 pounds. Reading 15 pages a night is 12 to 15 books a year. Like, these things grow. Or conversely, the bad decisions swing momentum in the opposite way. So I truly believe, and the one thing I would really impart on anyone is, you don't have to swing for the fences and change the world. Or frankly, even an organization that's winning the game by singles and doubles is going to be better off than the one that's swinging for the fences every time, because every gain and loss is a monumental shift in the entire framework. Whereas you lose a swing on a double, things are relatively okay. You gain a double, you just work it into the current infrastructure. And I think personally, professionally, independently, and as a collective, life is like that. If you put more debits in, you can pull a credit out when and if you need to, but if it's not there, you can't lean on it when you need it.
I really love that quote, and I love the concept of small things done consistently create big results. And I think that is, or can change the world. I think that's just a really powerful way to think about and to approach. We've talked about a lot of challenges between the economy and the challenges with loneliness and connection, with communication, with understanding analytics and managing performance. There's so many challenges that we're facing. And to be able to recognize that it's really just one small step at a time that's going to make a difference at overcoming, responding to, and dealing with all of those challenges that we face in our workplaces and in our various positions and experiences. So, Barry, thank you so much for coming on, for sharing your experiences, your background, your wisdom, your information with our audience. I am so grateful for your willingness to say yes and come join the Evolving to Exceptional podcast. To our listeners, as always, I like to end just remind you to always keep evolving, always keep growing, always keep looking for opportunities for how you can improve and continue to expand and grow and change your life in ways that allow you to live your very best life experience and enjoy your journey along the way. I hope you have a wonderful week, and we'll be back again next week with another episode.